My name is Keith Beavers, and I have a public service announcement. Have you subscribed to VinePair's YouTube channel? Because if you haven't, there is so much drink stuff going on there. Like, my God! What's going on, wine lovers from the VinePair Podcasting Network? This is the Wine 101 Podcast. My name is Keith Beavers, and I am the Tastings Director of VinePair. We're going to wrap this up. Burgundy goes mod, or modern, and a very important things solidify during this moment in its history. Cannot wait to tell you about it. Burgundy becomes the Burgundian state ruled by dukes. And we talked all about that last episode. But the thing is, good things don't last, or I don't know, some saying. But the dukes did not last. At some point, they had to come under the rule of France. It was inevitable. It took a long time. But there was this dude named Charles the Rash. The Rash. The story goes with this kid. I say kid because at the age of 12, he was already vying for power. He wasn't even old enough to rule yet, but he was like, I'm going to make this happen when I'm of age. What do you want to do when you grow up? I want to be a duke. And when dude became a duke, he did things differently than his predecessor, plural, I don't really know, but definitely his predecessor. He was a very combative duke. He was really big on expanding the Burgundian state all the way to Flanders, which is like all the way northwest, like through Champagne all the way north. And he wanted to do it through force and not diplomatic ways and means. And I don't want to get further into this because it doesn't really matter. But what matters is at some point, all that ambition, all that hubris didn't work because at some point he was overtaken by the French king at the time. And alas, the Burgundian state is over and comes under French rule. Now, that's important because not only is the French royalty kind of getting rid of dukes and their semi-autonomous law, they're also kind of getting tired of these priests and these monks. And as the monarchy begins to strengthen and power across France, the power of the church begins to decline. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time, but it's happening. And in the general history of Europe, this is towards the end of the Renaissance. The Renaissance is generally between the 14th and the 17th century. So you can kind of see this progression of the church being less important, not unimportant, but less important in a way that it had to occupy itself along with all of the progressiveness that is going on during the Renaissance. And actually, if you go to Florence, Italy, literally in downtown, old town Florence, Italy, you can see the transition from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance just by looking at churches. You see this big Gothic cathedral during the Middle Ages. You go down a block and you see a more humble church that was built after that cathedral, showing there's more humility and whatever's going on, and the arts and the sciences became more prominent. But whatever, this is kind of what's happening, and the nobility is gaining more in power and just kind of like, okay, priest, calm down. And in Burgundy, during the 17th century, many of these famous vineyards we've been talking about donated to the church during the Middle Ages were increasingly being sold to the important, rich, wealthy bourgeoisie of Dijon. But by this point, Burgundy is still kind of a local product because transportation is still not awesome, not fun, not cool, until something kind of big happens. Well, not big as in like better transportation. That doesn't come yet. We'll get to that in a second. But big as in the Sun King, Louis XIV's physician, Pierre Broge, I think that's how you pronounce his name. He was kind of a big deal. A bit of a mover and a shaker. Ended up getting hanged and framed for murder after Louis died. But anyway, he actually had wine. He had his own wine being made in the Mekong. And he is the one who prescribed Burgundy to the king instead of champagne. Remember in the champagne series I brought this up? Well, it was this guy. This physician is like, look, I know you like champagne, but you know what's better for your health is this white wine from Mekong. I happen to make it. I think it's better for you. And the Sun King's like, all right. And what's interesting, actually, if you read the actual content of this part of the story, it says old white Burgundy. So in Mekong, looks like white wine was actually being aged a bit. That's pretty cool. But at this point, we don't know if it's Chardonnay. It's probably Pinot Blanc. Chardonnay is probably part of this. Aligoté, Fermentaux. It probably is all those wine grapes. In the 18th century, road travel begins to improve, making it a lot easier to get product out of Burgundy. It's still not easy. We don't have a canal system yet or a railway. That's coming, definitely coming. But this does allow commercial traffic to actually start happening in Burgundy to get its name out there. And it was probably helped by King Louis going, this is what I drink for my health. And as a result of this commercial prosperity, or the beginnings of this commercial prosperity, this is when we start seeing the establishing of négociant houses in the 1720s and the 1730s. Some of which are still in business today in 2024. The biggest is Bouchard, established in 1731, which is today one of the Bones' largest wine merchants and vineyard holders. It was started by a textile merchant, which is pretty interesting. Textiles were a big deal in this part of France. So during the Champagne episode, we learned about that. Another connection to Champagne, this firm was eventually bought by Joseph Henriot, who is a Champagne house. Very good Champagne, by the way. He was once the guy who ran Veuve Clicquot. Kind of a small world going on over here. A lot of things are happening now, and Burgundy is becoming more known outside of Burgundy. And one of the big deals here is this guy who was a priest, Claude Arnault. In 1728, he wrote a book, I don't know if it was a book or it was a pamphlet or it was a work. It was a paper. It was called The Dissertation on the Situation on Vines in Burgundy. This guy was a priest in Beaune who ended up leaving his home and going to London to sell Burgundian wine in London. Like one of the first wine reps. I don't know if that's true. And this guy, this priest, did work like Dom Perignon because he actually had some pretty innovative stuff going on in this piece. One thing that was interesting as he was promoting the wines of the Côte de Nuit, we start seeing that, but also he was really promoting and repping the wines of Volnay, which at the time, and I'm not going to say it in French because I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, but it was called a partridge's eye. That was the name of the wine because when you killed a partridge, their eyes went a slight pinkish color. So it's a little bit dark, but the wines were the color of a dead partridge eye, which is kind of pink, and that was very popular at the time. So now we're seeing red wine and white wine being talked about in Burgundy. It's not just Pinot Noir and just Chardonnay yet, but we're starting to see the divide. There's definitely, you know, it's Gamay, it's Pinot Noir, it's Aligoté and Chardonnay and Pinot Blanc and stuff like that. But what's important about this dissertation is the word terroir pops up. It might be for the first time in a major publication where it's used to describe the optimal grape variety for a particular soil being important criteria for the character of a wine. It's also here where he says, for wines to be excellent, they must be brought from a single vineyard into a single barrel and then assessed separately. this was not the customary thing at the time. People were just throwing everything into a barrel, making it happen. But this guy's like, look, terroir is a thing, and individual production is a thing. And based on this stuff, this sort of isolation, he also says that this is a little bit wild. To truly enjoy, the wines must be drunk either through the nose or the mouth or both. That's a little confusing, but what that says to me is assessing, like take it in the nose. It's almost like a wine 101. Oh my God. And then we finally get to 1791 when France is like, we don't like the kings. We don't like the priests. We don't like this stuff. We are now an independent nation and they had a revolution. We all know what happened there. But from the late 18th century, like the 1790s, on, vineyards were sold off and often split between owners. And this is where that confusion of Burgundy comes into play for the consumer. Because then we have to add in the Napoleonic Code of Inheritance, where we bring back equal inheritance. So there's this very interesting entry in the Oxford Wine Companion that sums this all up. This process has caused much difficulty in understanding Burgundy. The consumer must familiarize themselves not only with a plethora of village and vineyard names, but also with the relative merits of possibly dozens of producers of each one. So if you've ever been confused about Burgundy, don't worry, everybody is. Unless you're obsessed with Burgundy and that's all you do. I am confused. Honestly, the best way, because I mean, I just love good wine, right? Wine lovers. And what's really the best way to get Burgundy around in your head is have somebody share or get a Burgundy that's suggested to you or whatever and drink it. And like, wow, this is really good. I like this. Then you can focus on the label, get all the information and start following the labyrinth of names and connections and merits and all that. It's a little intense. Because what happens next in Burgundy kind of adds to this potential confusion. But it's a really awesome moment. It's a terrible moment for Burgundy. But what comes of it is really great. Because in the 19th century, Burgundy was doing really well. And they actually brought back Gamay for a minute. Now, I'm going to talk about that in another episode coming up. It's a very interesting connection. Put a pin in that right now, right there, where Burgundy in the 19th century started planting more Gamay. Let's put a pin in that. But it's here in the 19th century where a canal system was developed in Burgundy and the Paris to Dijon railway happened. Oh man, that was everything. And then it wasn't. Because from the 1850s to the 1870s, Burgundy and all of France was hit with two big deals, powdery mildew, and you guessed it, phylloxera. But unfortunately, the Burgundians were in denial and did not accept the fact that phylloxera was happening until 1878, well into the destructive nature of this louse. But when they did, there's a story about a infested vineyard being surrounded by soldiers in Marceau. Not going to help, but I guess they were pretty desperate because they had waited so long to accept the fact this was happening. It got to the point where there were two factions, people that wanted the treatments to happen, people that didn't want the treatments to happen. There was still a lot of denial going on. And there was this thing called the American solution, which was grafting American rootstocks onto European vines. And that was like, no, we are not doing that. There's even a story where people that are sent into the region to spray were attacked by an angry mob. Wine history in France, a lot of riots and attackings. Now, American rootstock was banned in France for quite some time, but in the region of Burgundy, it was banned between 1874 and 1887, well past the national ban. It took them a minute. They came around by the late 19th century, like the 1890s, post-phylloxera wines were on the market from Burgundy. So they eventually got the American rootstock thing happening. But this is the moment here where real modern Burgundy is realized. Because like a lot of places in Europe, phylloxera just decimated the region. Replanting had to happen. But the thing is, the word terroir comes from this place for reasons. And over time, people knew about the idea of terroir. They understood the variation in quality of wines that are produced by different plots of land, or as the Burgundians call them, clima. So after all the suffering of this louse and powdery mildew, this whole thing was kind of in, it equates a little bit to, oh my God, I'm trying to find, it equates a little bit to a vine pool scheme. When a region is like, we have too many vines, rip them all up, replant, let's focus here. But it was phylloxera that did that for the Burgundians. And they replanted in some of the most famous soils that have been around and realized since Clos Vougeot. And in 1855, while Bordeaux was having a moment, a man by the name of Dr. Laval wrote The History and Statistics of the Côte d'Or. And in this book, I don't know, is it a book? Is it a pamphlet? When people published, I don't know, I'm going to call it a book. It's a book. It's in this book that the CRU system was born. He included a very informal classification of the best vineyards. It was eventually formalized, this classification system, in 1861 by the Bonne Committee of Agriculture, who devised the classes of these vineyards with the aid of Dr. Laval. And most of those vineyards are now Grand Cru vineyards in the official 1930s AOC appellation system of France. Now the planting is more focused. Everything's very exciting. Things start to flourish. And then World War I happens and things start to get bad. And the 1920s happens and things get worse with the depression into the early 1930s. And it's bad. There's no money to be had. And the people in Burgundy are trying to figure out a way to make this work. One big problem was the merchants. These producers did not want to deal, a lot of them did not want to deal with merchants. So there were two solutions in Burgundy around this time to kind of get the power back of the wine and vine grower. One was cooperatives. There was a cooperative happening in the Mâconnais, and it was very popular, so that started happening. But the big deal, the thing that really changed everything in Burgundy, was for producers to bottle their own produce. Domains. Not selling your wine to merchants. Doing it yourself. Having control over everything you do. In a place called Burgundy, with very chaotic soils and climats and terroir, being able to express your wine from your domain. This is really the realization of Burgundy. It began with Marquis d'Angerville, that became Domaine Marquis d'Angerville, that is still being made today. He was like, I'm done. I'm doing it all myself. And then the second guy, Henri Gauge, known for starting this thing, he actually moves into the area, starts making wine, and then sees what Marquis is doing, and he starts to do it. And then other people started doing it, and it was a snowball effect. And the merchants were like, whoa, what are you guys doing? And this became the identity of Burgundy, where in 1962, wines produced and bottled by growers only accounted for 15% of the production. By 1990, half of all wines from the Côte d'Or were domain bottled. In a 2011 study, 58% of all Burgundy was sold by 250 négociants, 26% by 3,800 domains, and 16% by 23 co-ops. Those numbers, did you get that? 58% of all Burgundy is sold by only 250 négociants, but 26% by almost 4,000 domains. That's where Burgundy fine wine Burgundy is, right there in that 26% sweet spot. there, and that's where the confusion is too. 3,800, and I'm sure there's more. Now, it's just like, that's a lot in a very small, in a smaller percentage. And packed into that are Grand Cru vineyards, Premier Cru vineyards, village names, people's names with hyphens of other people that they've married. It's just an absolute labyrinth of some of the most beautiful wine in the world today. But that, wine lovers, is the history of Burgundy. This is how Burgundy became what it is today. And what a long road, but how different is this story than Bordeaux, than Champagne? It's so fascinating. I think I said this last series, but I just find it how these are pretty close to each other. I mean, you got to drive, but like, it's France. It's pretty close to each other, and everyone developed differently. It's just fascinating. Okay, next week, I have a little surprise. We're going to do a supplemental. It's going to be about some Gamay. Let's talk next week. Vine Pair Keith is my Insta. Rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps get the word out there. And now for some totally awesome credits. Wine 101 was produced, recorded, and edited by yours truly, Keith Beavers, at the Vine Pair headquarters in New York City. I want to give a big old shout out to co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon for creating Vine Pair. And I mean, big shout out to Danielle Grinberg, the art director of Vine Pair, for creating the most awesome logo for this podcast. Also, Darby Seaside for the theme song. Listen to this. And I want to thank the entire Vine Pair staff for helping me learn something new every day. See you next week.